Hello, Ben.
Hello, Bob.
It's great being on Saturday night. What was interesting is that it went from July 4th, this first show, into July 5th, which is the famous date of X Day in the Church of the Subgenius. So it's very timely that my first time on London Radio in the proper context with you was on X Day. Went into X Day.
This gets quite strange for people listening to this to understand, because we're commenting on the fact that now on our 14th show, we're aware that the first show has started to be broadcast by Resonance Radio. So we're in a loop of 14 hours of show, and we're looking back at the beginning of the show and then listening to it and finding that we said all sorts of things we can't even remember. And at least that's my experience. You probably remember everything with your CIA background and all.
Exactly, and I didn't even have to listen to it again.
But what you're talking about is being aware now of this becoming, because we're having these discussions and we've always talked with a kind of formality and a kind of awareness that someone's going to listen to this at some point. We were kind of making shows, weren't we, and we're putting it up on archive.org so people can get them straight away. But this is now's the time in which it's become actual radio somewhere.
Yes, and I don't see 12 and 13 up on the archive.org. Have you not put them up yet?
Maybe not. Okay. I'll have to get on the case with those ones. Because time becomes funny with recording, doesn't it? Because I was listening to Electric Ladyland very loud today, which people should do more often. I'm talking about Jimi Hendrix's final masterpiece. And because I heard a little snippet of it on Resonance, and in 6 minutes into Moon, the one about the moon, I will turn to be, he says, let's go to the show. And this immediately had a resonance for me of Nanook's mother on the first track of Apostrophe by Frank Zappa saying, save your money, don't go to the show. And so I thought, I should check this out. So I got out Electric Ladyland and put it on, and for some reason it was very loud and it just sounded fantastic. And I was basking and swimming within the Hendrix effluvium of expression and realizing that Frank Zappa's Apostrophe is all about Hendrix.
Yeah, what I'm thinking of as you talk is Zappa didn't compliment too many rock bands, but in 68 he said that he liked Jimi Hendrix. Right at the period when he's trying to establish his mark, he was nice enough to say, go listen to Hendrix. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and Jimmy turned up at the photo session for We're In It For The Money, and there he is.
Yeah, and he's part of that, then he's part of the conception.
And Carl Schenkel cut out a picture of Moon Zappa and put him in Hendrix's arms. Put her picture in his arms, like he's the nanny or something, you know, like he's trusting his daughter with this man.
He has a special role.
Yeah, because I believe he is actually standing there in the studio when the photo shoot happened. He's not collaged in, because a lot of it is people put there with cut and paste. But my understanding is that Hendrix was actually standing there for the photograph.
Yeah, well, it seems that they were friends.
And I think Apostrophe is Frank Zappa's reflection on what Hendrix's guitar and this efflorescence of R&B, because they both shared roots in the sense that the music they really liked was the 50s black R&B, and Jimi Hendrix was a jobbing session musician. I mean, he toured for Little Richard and got fired because he wore as loud shirts as Little Richard. Little Richard couldn't take that. But he was a jobbing musician within the undercurrent, this quite kind of low-level kind of musical stratum that Frank Zappa adhered to. And Hendrix came from there. And then, of course, he got to London and there was a Jimi Hendrix experience and it kind of boomed. But he had that knowledge of R&B in his head. He couldn't do anything that wasn't coming out of that, and it's like an explosion from there. And Zappa respected that. He liked it because it came from this particular culture that he loved, in a way that he didn't like the Beatles, because he felt that the Beatles didn't really come from there. They were some sort of pop outfit trying to copy this and that, and they didn't have this authenticity. But the point which does come back to what we were talking about is about time and about us talking about the weirdness of recording and the fact that we're talking now in real time, but we're talking about the fact that the first of these conversations has now gone out on a radio show twice now on Resonance, and therefore our own presence here is mediated by the fact that we know that it can exist in other times. And I think Zappa's apostrophe is all about time, and I think it is about Hendrix, because if you listen to Electric Ladyland, Hendrix is doing something with time, because he is overtracking recordings played at different speeds. This is something Prince picked up on a lot, but that with a multi-track tape recorder, you can actually do it so that some of the tracks are in different times to your own. So that there's a big usage of slowed down vocals in Electric Ladyland. Very weird textures created by slowing down the tape so your voice becomes really deep and slow. And Hendrix is using that, and you become aware of a floating system where nothing is in real time. You're being collaged into these different time zones, and time has become multiplicious and overlaid and back, held back and pushed forward. Now, I think that's just bringing to consciousness how we actually are, because we are dealing with presentness. You're there in Maui, I'm here. It's all instant. We're not doing any trickery, but in our heads we're aware of where this recording could be used, where it might be stashed, someone else listening to it. So to be really responsible about this instantness we're in and what excites us and makes us articulate, we should be aware of all these different time zones it could fit in.
Yeah, that's what Joyce does in Finning's Wake. McLuhan articulates a lot of that and the causes of it, the techno causes, and Zappa works with that. And I
this relates now directly to the quote that I wanted to ask you about.
Right.
Because you're comparing Frank Zappa. Okay, sorry. I'll hang back. I'll let you say something. Sorry.
Yeah. This is important. I've always wondered what Zappa meant in We're Longing for the Money when he said, come with me and discorporate. Because what you just described technically is a discorporation in your normal physical body's time sense. So could discorporate refer to the occult thing, astral projection, or did he mean playing with time and what Electric Ladyland was doing? You see what I'm saying? Discorporate. What does that mean to come discorporate, leave your body? Remember the lyrics?
Of course. Discorporate and come with me, drifting, shifting, and going into lyrics, which obviously Zappa is... he's sneering at that. Zappa is not a person to say drifting, shifting, and let's all sort of dream. He's always somebody blowing the whistle and tripping you up and making you think and so on. So discorporate must be something that he's sneering at, that he doesn't agree with.
Right. It could mean he's making fun of the hippie dream, to the occult stuff that was in the LA Free Press at the time. In the San Francisco hippie
he picture. Is, but he believes...
But he also could mean that he's disconnecting from the corporate business world and drop out. It's a multi-level world, and I think that he was showing, at least in his context, the way he was playing with time.
Yes, but it is your physical meat sack, as you called it earlier off mic, that can entertain all these ideas. You see, if you don't want to split into... Either you're in your body and you're a slightly dull person who brings home the bacon, as Devo mocked the average man, and have a split between that and the bohemia that exists in society, where everybody seems to be doing everything exciting and free and wowie zowie. If you think actually these two things are extremely connected, then what you say is that to entertain all these ideas of time zones and everything is not something that means you discorporate, that you can incorporate the knowledge that all these things happening in your brain are a material manifestation at a very small molecular nervous level in your brain, but it's not a completely different world, that these two things are connected.
Well, what is the strangeness that we're thinking of when we are aware that we're recording something that's going to be broadcast later and there's other things being broadcast from earlier? Is that all part of your material corporeality?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything which is not part of my material corporeal reality, because I don't really know what else it could be.
So what is the point of mentioning the multiple? That means our corporality has been altered by new technical possibilities, and therefore we have new images of what we're doing and new self-consciousness or new meta about ourselves.
Well, of course, in the evolution from the amoeba to multicellular organisms, huge new possibilities and potentials have developed, and the way humanity has developed hasn't been in terms of genetic mutations of the basic DNA core. It's been in social developments of what we can be, and that's the thing which the geneticists don't seem to have grasped, that the extraordinary history of the last couple of millennia in human history has not been a biological evolution, it's been a social evolution. And that's what this current regime of capitalism, with its individualistic emphasis on property, can't really grasp, is the social element, is this mind-bending extraordinariness that is more than being a mere individualistic competing animal.
Exactly, and that was McLuhan's point. He would quote Hans, somebody who wrote a book called Man's Presumptuous Brain, who was a scientist, and McLuhan in the 70s would read the quote where the scientists would say that man's brain biologically has stopped evolving, you know, millennia, millions of years ago, whatever it was, and the only evolution going on is our technological, social, cultural evolution. That is the evolution, and our old ancient brain can't handle the new technological evolution.
So why can't it handle it? Isn't it the tool that's doing it?
That I agree with that, but I'm just pointing out that McLuhan played with that quote, which he played with what you're saying.
Yeah, he played with it, but I think he... You see, I still think that even though you've shown me that McLuhan is a lot more perceptive
like
and interesting...
He's a lot like you, Ben.
Yeah, well, he's a lot more interesting than I thought he was, than I did, you know, if we wind back to our inaugural discussions or before then, that there's still an element of a crass misunderstanding in McLuhan, that he still believes that the natural part of man is individualistic and competitive, and that it must be some add-on to get him out of that.
Oh, no, he didn't believe that. He believed that the competitive self was a product of the printing press and that it was a short-term development and it would be changed. That was his prediction. The individualistic capitalist self will not be around within the next 50 years, so to speak.
Right, okay.
No, that was his point. We were being changed. And he would
but why,
exactly.
You see...
Remember, he went to the Bilderbergers and was shocked at how old-fashioned they were.
But it's the techno-determinist aspect of what you're saying that I can't really swallow, which is always it's these inventions which seem like gods or myths to me. I mean, if Vico was writing about McLuhan, he would say, well, he's replaced the various myths and heroes that people used to have in the past that changed everything with things called the printing press or the television or, you know, these technological inventions. But these have all been produced by thinking, active human beings. And I'd rather have a system that understood how purposive human beings are and how filled with intention they are and how it is humans that actually make history, not products of themselves. That I think McLuhan's problem is the thing that William Blake criticized in Religion. People invent gods and they are extremely... articulate ways of positing what they want and what they feel. They're very expressive. Why artists always have a soft spot for myths and religion. But these things harden into systems where you believe they are more real than you are. And you need a continual revolt and criticism of those things to make you realize that these are merely things made by people.
That's exactly what he always said. Remember, Bakunin said all his writings were Menippean satire, a satire on the surface manners of life. He never had a theory. He pointed out, as long as you don't know what's going on, you're going to be a dupe of technological determinism.
Well,
and that is part of Marxist and normal history.
Well, but that's the element of irony or humor or criticism, which, for example, Wired magazine absolutely excised from their pages. They never had it. They took it that somehow the technology will free us, and therefore if you buy the laptop you will be free. And this is really, I mean, as a personal confession, why I had to stop writing for Wired magazine, not Wired with a D on the end, the magazine about new technology and computing and so on, but the music magazine, because it was considered absolutely vile and nasty of me to make fun of people who thought that if they had a laptop they became brilliant musicians. And I'd seen these people bore me to death. I had to confess, I had to say, you know, just because somebody's got a laptop with a little apple on it and a shiny light, and, you know, because they're doing that doesn't make them fantastic, you know. I mean, not that I'm against technology, if you use it to do anything, you know, I'm there, I'm with ears open, you know, do what you can do. And but that technological fix, the idea that the technology, you see, when you express McLuhan, before I start complaining about it, and you say, no, it's Menippean satire, you are laying out the stupid argument about new technology, which leads towards the rampant stupid consumerism of people believing if they can invest their £1,000 or whatever it is at the moment to get the computer, then they're lifted to a higher level, and now we can really start.
And I never said they're higher level. To a different quality characteristic type of psychology. He said human nature was changed. But let me just tell you about a Wired. When Wired came out in the spring of 93, I immediately recognized the flaw they were propagating. And at the same time, Nelson Thaw put out those albums. So Wired sent a journalist to me to talk about McLuhan, and I nailed them, speaking on behalf of McLuhan, nailed what they were doing, criticized them so much, and said, this is what McLuhan would tell you, that they wouldn't print the article.
This becomes the secret text that I must get hold of, the anti-cyber McLuhanite argument.
I did a long essay, I could send it to you, on that. On the real history of McLuhan. It was published in the Fordham Legacy of McLuhan Symposium book. It's in an academic book.
Right, an apology to radio listeners who feel that listening to radio is a good thing, that we have these lacunae, that means a little gap in how we're speaking now, where we have to refer to some kind of underground pocket of dense matter. Imagine a dinosaur rotting away and turning into oil. We're now talking about these deposits of oil beneath the surface of smooth radio comprehensibility that we need to access in order to get our engines going to keep talking in the way we've been talking over the last 14 programs. Yeah?
I'm not sure what your point was. What do we need to do?
Well, I'm wondering why here we are talking on the radio where everything should be oral and communicative and improvised, and then suddenly you have to refer to some buried article written down in some, you know, journal or somewhere it's been written that needs to be referred to. It's just an interesting sudden change, because Bob, one of your points is that you feel you've flown free of all that academic leaden weights on your wings. You know, you are the new flying albatross of the McLuhanite understanding of how to use media and the new relations to the senses that implies, that people listening to us are using their ears, they're not using their eyes scanning a text in a library, they're able to lie back and their bodily posture can be different from hunched over a book. And yet suddenly we're talking about something important that was written and published, or not published, but, you know, the dense and down there in the literary area, you know?
Well, you're the one who, when I suggested that, I just mentioned that I went after Wired, and you said, "Well, Bob, where is this? You're the one who requested."
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure. I mean, I'm not trying to accuse you. I'm just interested in the way our conversation is going. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So what I say right now is this is a perfect time to bring on the quote that you sent me, because that relates to a way to talk about this.
Okay. And the quote is, and I'll say it, Zappa's oeuvre is a polemic in favor of oral versus literate culture. And my question is...
No, yeah, carry on.
Yeah, my question is, and I think we're both agreed on that, and it's a violent polemic. It's a shocking polemic. And those phrases came to me simply because I suddenly understood that Zappa actually listened to anybody he met because he felt he could get a life from them and a whole community of people talking, and he related to that. And he didn't much like the conversation of the literate people because he felt that that was very reduced to just one idea, one allowed set of ideas. What he liked was the underclass, because beneath there you get real histories of people talking and thinking, and he respected that.
Yes, yeah, so just before you continue, that is in his autobiography where he memorializes meeting the guy out in the desert in the early 60s. He went to his trailer and the guy was playing Stravinsky or something. Remember that story?
Of course.
He was a weird dancer or something in the club, and then he got Frank at the Gnome. But that was a very significant experience for Frank to meet this person and go in and find they were kindred spirits or something.
Mm. Well, it's the hatred of the producers with Perrier breath. The feeling that, and actually that goes for academia today, because they've all absorbed French theory and it comes out as Perrier breath, i.e. breath of nothing. And what he liked was the exploitative old guys who'd chomp a cigar. And that idea of real taste and experience and tang and darkness and something that not reducible to the Perrier bubble is everything about his polemic. But I think of Frank Zappa's work as polemical, as I've always had a problem in normal company when I play his records. And you often say, well, Frank Zappa, we both often say, I have to say I'm within this too, that Frank Zappa and James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake is all the same thing. But I wonder about, and this is the question I want to ask you, is that Zappa feels spiky and polemical in a way I'm not sure I feel Finnegan's Wake is. That Finnegan's Wake hasn't got this urgency or attack to me. It's almost naive. I think Joyce hoped that via the book people would adopt his view of things, that it doesn't have the jarring quality.
Okay, so continue.
Or do you squeeze them together? Or do you have some McLuhanite, well, in different epochs, this stage, this is applicable, and then this stage, that's applicable, which I find a bit of a sort of dull way of answering what I'm saying, because I'm asking you how you feel when you listen to Zappa or you read Finnegan's Wake, you know, the difference.
Okay. I want you now to read the second part of what you sent me, and then I'll answer that.
Okay. Because, well, I was backing up the idea that they are the same thing by saying both Frank Zappa and James Joyce are for informal versus formal knowledge. They both support peasant paganism versus the Latinate clerisy. And that sends me into a whole idea of McLuhan, James Joyce, Frank Zappa, understanding an aesthetic critique of the bourgeoisie, because they understand the Middle Ages and the system that existed before capitalism so well, that they are medievalists. And I think I relate to them in that way because of my attachment to the medieval way of doing things and an interest in pre-bourgeois forms. So, I mean, that was like a gloss on what I'm saying, that Zappa, James Joyce are the same thing. Now, the other thing I want to say is nothing at all to do with the distinction between Frank Zappa and James Joyce, and goes off on thinking about Zappa's concept of music could only exist given the idea of reading the score. It is not velvet-style drone folk music. And that has to do with, is the idea of universalism simply a structuralist, Latinate oppression, or do we require it in order to even think? Where is the universal, Bob? That's the question I want to ask you. Is the universal an oppressive an oppressive system that doesn't allow us to breathe? Or what's the difference between the Roman Empire and, after it's been smashed, those few monks who said, here is Latin, if we can speak this, we can communicate with everybody, not just in our vernacular tongues about this village here, we can talk to the people hundreds of miles away, thousands of miles away. Is the idea of universalism immediately oppressive? What's your first response to that question?
My first response is for you to read the last section of the attachment, and don't say read sing, say what you intend reading. Just read the sentence, the second sentence, and finish it.
Okay.
And say reading in quotes. Okay, all read right. It.
Conversely, Zappa's concept of music could only exist given the idea of reading the score. Zappa's music is not velvet-style drone folk music.
Yeah, Velvet Underground. Okay, so you have there, Zappa is a polemic of the oral against the
literate. Yeah.
The literate. But he played reading music. They had to be skilled, his musicians. He played with the eye and the ear because he was neither. And I'll bring in this word tactile. And what tactile means is the interplay, and it's a primitive medieval sensibility. The medieval culture was tactile, according to McLuhan. So tactile is balanced. And to be balanced, you're neither oral or visual. You're more, you're behind, you're interpenetrating them. And that is the secret of Zappa's music, Joyce's style, and what McLuhan was making, is to understand that the universal common sense, the sensus communis was the term in the medieval period, by Thomas Aquinas and that.
Yeah.
That was the interplay of the senses, not embedded in any particular one. And you can look at Zappa's playing with all forms, literate, reading, and pagan, primitive, peasant, folklore culture, or urban blues. All these things were gist for his material. And McLuhan said Burroughs was onto this, and it was a retrieval of the Egyptian sensibility. The Egyptians were a tactile culture, and the artists, really the elite, the pharaohs, programmed the whole environment. Joyce wanted to program the whole world, and so did McLuhan and Zappa, not to dominate it, but to show the interplay of all this with our modern sensibility, which McLuhan said was the electric environment enhancing tactility and extending it. So Zappa is neither there nor here, eye or ear. He's in between. He's para, around, above, and below. And that's the best you can get to tactile. And if you think of tactile as texture and timbre, he says in the Bob Marshall interview how much he's interested in pitch and timbre. And he's also, took anything as music. If you move the cigarettes in your ashtray, you're a composer. That's the very thing Joyce did with Finnegan's Wake. So, universalism in a literate culture is oppressive. But when you're the monks in 600 AD and you're a minority, it was a balance to bring in literacy to play off the dominant Dark Age oral sensibility. Now, McLuhan used the phrase audile tactile. There's oral and visual, but then the audile tactile has tactility in it, but it is what people think today is oral culture. But audile tactile is Joyce, McLuhan, and Zappa, and William Burroughs. That's my opening statement.
Well, it sounds to me like, it's so good, it's like a closing statement. Sorry, I was just enjoying that and forgetting that we have to engage in dialogue.
Okay, well, let me give you...
I'm getting closer to your tactility term, because, 14 discussions ago, tactility was difficult for me because I always thought of just touching. So I always thought, well, that's another sense.
The kinetic pressure.
Yeah, but I always thought
the kinetic pressure.
Yeah, well, let me tell you how I misunderstood it because it might help you talk to other people. You know, just the first time you get all these terms, and so we're talking about ear, eye, listening, looking, those separation of senses, and then you bring up tactility, and then I think, well, oh, that's touching, that's another of the senses. Oh, that's a important one, but how can then just stressing another sense solve problems between the other two senses? Do you see what I mean? So tactility seems like a funny word for it for me, because it should be unitary or digesting or using everything or esoplastic or some term that isn't connected to a sense, because touch is another sense.
That's
so
right.
It feels like you're like supporting one of the senses versus all the others, so it's confusing.
Right, and I always say, I've dealt with this objection or misunderstanding for 25, 30 years, and I always say, tactility is not a sense, it's the interplay of the senses.
Yeah, well, I know it should be, and it is in your system, but when you first say it, it brings to mind, you for 25 years, you've been using the wrong word, Bob.
No, I've explained it. And the thing is, in your case, when I said the word, I had to put up with three or more shows of you responding and hallucinating on it. You were responding and you didn't hear my corrections. But that's okay. I'm not complaining. It just takes a while for Ben to stop talking,
Yeah, well, it does. It takes a while for me to stop talking. But that's exactly the same. If you measure it, it's exactly the same distance that separates the average radio listener from Bob Dobbs.
Yeah, do you understand that touching is, for most people, sensory contact, pressure. That is not tactility. That is kinetic. You press, you touch, you feel something. If tactility is not a sense, then the closest it is when you remove your hand from what you're touching or pressing on, and then you touch it again. Then you remove your hand. McLuhan used to say that interval was the closest to the esoplastic nature of tactility. When I read your book and you defined esoplastic, I said, that's tactility. Tactility is the interplay of the senses that unifies them into coherent consciousness.
The best example of what Marshall McLuhan is talking about in talking about on and off would be the ring finger of Jimmy McGriff's hand on a Hammond organ key on his keyboard when he's trembling it, and you suddenly realize you're listening to music which is more like sex than anything you've ever heard, because it actually reproduces the trembling excitement of someone touching you and not touching you and squeezing you and then letting off the pressure. And do you know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. That's it. But tactility, that's approximate of tactility, because tactility is not a sensory interaction, but the interval, the rhythm, the beat, the audile tactile is like African music.
But the idea that communication could be a full-on it's like you're trying to talk about Morse code and then you're saying, well, would communication just be going beep forever? Would that be, well, obviously not. Only in breaking it can you actually talk. So it's like to produce tactility is a great argument versus something. It's like you're a stranded person trying to think properly in an arena of complete idiots. And this is probably my problem with McLuhan, is that he's a lonely proto-dialectical thinker in a ruling country of pragmatism that cannot understand what he means, which is why I find it, and my tendency would be to go to where the culture is rich in people who all understand this stuff and can really talk to each other, which is why I go to Germany and Russia in the 1920s, where there were loads of people who understood this. who are all arguing with each other, who are all inventing new ideas. It's not just one man with a polemic versus, you know, a sea of incorrigible Philistine idiocy. It's actually a system of communication and correspondence, and, you know, people are building things. And it's just that you've found McLuhan, and bless you, Bob, for finding McLuhan in the desert of ideas, which is capitalist America. But I find it weird, because I'm coming from an area, not that it's simple, that in Europe we have all this, because it's been smashed in the face and it's been obliterated, and we had the Nazis to wipe out the great German efflorescence of great ideas, and we had Stalinism to wipe out the great efflorescence in Russia. So it's not like in Europe we all sit easily with all this stuff. We're mining it and discovering it. But there are areas where all this, these arguments are like, hi, you know, everybody is talking to each other on an intelligent level. Like we're trying to do, or maybe we're doing. Do you see what I mean? That I find McLuhan is like pitched against such an array of incomprehending nincompoops that almost to keep on with McLuhan is to always be hitting your head against a wall.
Yeah, well, I don't stay with McLuhan. I use all kinds of different methods. Like Zappa did and Joyce did. So I will quote from your book to show you an aspect of what you're getting at. Art, Class, and Cleavage is the book, page 292 at the bottom. You say, in 1910, Sigmund Freud wrote an article called, quote, The Antithetical Sense of Primal Words. Now, let's just think of primal as earlier culture, pre-literate, tactile cultures, adult tactile cultures. So you continue. Freud declared that he had found linguistic confirmation of his discovery that dreams frequently represent elements by their opposites. According to the philologist Carl Abel, ancient Egyptian has many words that mean one thing and also its opposite. See, that'd be a tactile culture. They don't stay on one side. Literacy emphasizes one meaning over another. Oral culture may not be as tactile, especially if it gets into writing and early writing. So it starts to solidify slightly, but not as much as the printing press era. Back to this. So the same is true of many early Indo-European and Semitic languages. Abel pointed out that Egypt was not the quote, home of nonsense, same accusation against McLuhan, Joyce, and Zappa, but on the contrary, quote, one of the earliest seats of the development of human wisdom, unquote. A civilization that could make glass and build the pyramids, quote, must at least have had sufficient sense not to regard a thing at one and the same time itself and its opposite.
But about languages, I mean, Hegel claimed that German was peculiarly suited to philosophy because they had words that meant the same and the opposite. And he claimed that for German. So this flexibility about ideas and this idea that what you're arguing is actually it's an assault on Christianity, because what you're saying is the idea we can lock some terms into sin, you know, that's all bad. If we could get rid of that, then this would be good. That the dialectical idea that you've got, that ideas of real words, really important, useful words, can also mean their opposite, mean that you have to work within context, that there is no saving yourself by stacking up all the good side versus the bad side, because you have to improvise within any context to show what you mean, and therefore there is nothing that's taboo because everything can be used, and there's no safe area where we can just get rid of the bad side. You always have to dance around all this stuff and do what you need to do, and hopefully a good thing, but you're there's no safety in choosing the bits and pieces that you use. And that corresponds, I'm sure it does, with your experience as well, with my whole experience with music. I can't stand people who just decide, well, this area of music is okay, and that music, we obviously know, I despise them. When always the best musical experiences anybody has is where the thing they thought they really didn't like suddenly emerges as a thing that really turns them on. And that change is real bliss. That's real musical experience, when something you didn't think you ought to like becomes fantastic. And that understanding is what this turning into opposites could articulate or is about.
Exactly. I would say that me and McLuhan were critical of visually biased Christians. We like tactile Christians. All right? Tactile Christians is what we're talking about here. So to continue, because your way of talking about dialectics is exactly the way McLuhan meant tactility. See, so this is the interesting overlap here. Now, you are presenting a literate version and a political version of dialectics, but you have a value system. The aesthetics part is toward tactility, even though you didn't know that, but it's the same thing.
Absolutely. This is what needs to be loaded in. My argument has always been that Marxism has become too conceptual and needs to understand the musical and physical import of your responses to things, which is part of the argument of saying that Marxism loses its way without enough Freud, that the revolution in Russia went wrong when Freud was no longer talked about, when that was banned, when Stalin started saying we need the family, we need the nation. When all these reactionary ideas came in, Marxism actually loses any power it has. That the Freudian element is the element of stressing your need to express. But the reason I choose music as a thing to talk about is I think since the 60s, music has become the location of subjectivity. There is no way of talking about subjectivity without referring to people's taste in music, because there you get something where they're militant about it and they're not going to budge and they're going to say they like it, and you've got a real expressive argument on your hands where you have to improvise with all your concepts to deal with somebody's taste in music. So, also, because music is not simply arbitrary, because of the way capitalism has done music, it's become a universal system. So in talking about music, we are talking about the whole thing. We can't not talk about the whole thing because of the way universal capitalism has taken all our music and turned it into something else. And so you are turned to the it's got in it the exact contradiction between your expression of subjectivity and the very specific that is you, and having to look at the entire world that is working on you.
Yeah, very good. The reason you can focus in your polemic on music is that in a tactile, electrified, extended tactile culture, the closest to that is the oral or the audio. So audio hyphen tactile. So music is the best under TV or electric conditions for getting a handle, because you can't talk about tactility or experience it because it's not a sense. It's just a patterning. Okay, so you project tactile values into the musical experience. That's what you're doing. You're not limiting to oral categories like jazz or rock and that. You go about consuming it as a tactile person, and the media environment you live in enables you to do that.
The usual thing thrown at me when I try and do this is not that I'm a tactile person, but I'm an intellectual person. I'm introducing concepts and politics which sort of belong on the, it's kind of repressive to introduce these ideas because we're trying to get down. We're trying to get down, and to introduce all this stuff is kind of the wrong level of your brain, you know, because we really want to get down. But whenever I found the stuff that really gets down, and I'm thinking about James Brown, I found it absolutely bluntly about history and politics, that's what it is. That's what it's forcing you up against. And thinking about it is no block. But then, I mean, this comes to, how do you dance, Bob?
I'm an excellent dancer. There's a YouTube up there. You can look at me. It says the greatest dancer of all time.
Well, there you go. But don't you think that dancing is about interaction between a surrender to some kind of machinic physical part of you and a continual joke about yourself as a thinking person doing it? And that is what dancing is.
Yeah, dancing is another close expression of tactility, because it's the interplay between the head and the toe, and there's the gap. And the Japanese say, I know it from head to toe. They're the most tactile culture. Also, McLuhan considered Russia and Germany, we talked about Germany as tactile cultures, but the dancing, look at the Yeats's line, how can you tell the dancer from the dance? That's tactility. There's the beginning of the vortices tactile values. The Yeats, belatedly started to pick up on this stuff from Pound.
Well, I think you can tell the dancer from the dance by being a little bit more analytical and intelligent about what the relationship between your body and culture is than Yeats was. I mean, there's a squashing of everything together. I mean, you know, James Joyce is a revolt against Yeats and the what he called the cultic toilette, against that petty bourgeois notion of some regressive learning Gaelic and sitting on your ass dressed in green playing a lyre. He hated that. You know, the Joyce thought, we're in a modern world. I mean,
that's right.
You know,
true. Yeats didn't make the team.
Yeah, absolutely.
He came out with Pound in 1916 at the London Cottage, tried to get it, and he kind of said, yeah, you guys are it. But he couldn't really make the transition. But he was there picking up the early impulses. They all were impressed with Yeats when they were young. But anyways, let's go back to the more important point, Ben, is that the idea of talking ideas, Ben Watson's an intellectual in relation to this odd tactile culture. That's a tactile response, Ben, because you're including all the senses. You're including the eye and literacy and ideas. Why did Zappa, in the middle of a rock, if he had been, imagine him at Woodstock, he would have come out with a band, rocked away for a while, and then put it down and put up his conducting baton and started conducting. Everybody said, what the heck is that guy doing? We don't want a classical composer here. You know what I mean? He included the eye in his tactile interplay.
Yeah, and also, also in his guitar improvisations, you can hear time go by. Now, are you still there? I heard a funny noise.
No, it's just somebody phoning.
Right, okay. Well, yeah, funny noises happen. Phones.
Yeah, no, the phone rang.
But because if I confess to you, the reason I always liked Frank's music, I liked Mother's Invention music, and I didn't like the other stuff, was that I could hear time going by. That I could hear that there wasn't simply a sonic bath that I could be in. There was a thing happening which required that I watch this, and then it changed, and then this happened, and that happened. And I think that is very related to the idea of writing music down in terms of people reading a score, that when you're going through time, there is a thing that you're going through. I mean, this is what put me at loggerheads with so many arguments about what modern music is, because so much theory about modern music since John Cage has been about, we've transcended linear thinking. We are now in a mystic zone where everything, you know all that bullshit. I don't need to go through it with you. But there's a difference, isn't there? Because, or is it the same? Because I began the show talking about the multiple universe of Hendrix that I love diving into. But at the same time, given the different times which Hendrix is creating through the multi-track system, so he has got a slowed down vocal on one track and a sped up guitar on the other, and he's playing in real time there, each time that anyone is in actually matters. It's not a matter of melting it all away and saying time doesn't exist, that there are multi-times and everyone's living in different times. I mean, this is like respect for people's different experience with their upbringing and their different cultural zones they've come from, and everybody has a trajectory and it's all sort of speeding through and bumping into each other, and that's what society is. I don't want to reduce everything to one single time, which is what capitalism does and why we are able to talk to each other, because we know at 11 o'clock we switch on the Skype. But that reduction of everything to one time is not what I mean when I'm saying I need to hear time in music, that I don't respect a guitar solo if they don't seem to know how long they've had me listening to them, and whether I'm getting bored, and if they're playing with that with repetition or not, and building up to we can see the ending, and they're going to do some kind of interesting thing here, and then they're going to deny me and then give it there. That for me is playing, and if somebody isn't playing like that, I can't really listen to them.
Yeah, there's a tactile interplay. I think you say in the beginning, the preface in your Derek Bailey book, I haven't read much of the book yet, but you talk about the audience has a right to interact with what the musician is saying. There's a dialogue, yeah. And you're asking the musician to be sensitive to what he's doing to the audience. That's tactile, that's dialectical.
That's the absolute requirement, that not being interested in your audience of... I mean, people get very confused because of the... And I relate it to a class system or political argument, that a lot of avant-gardes have been very polemical against a self-satisfied, complacent bourgeoisie. So people believe creative music has to always... creative art, creative literature, creative anything has to be polemical against the society it's in. And that is correct. But the only way to be polemical against the society you're in is to communicate with some people to try and build something to change that society. That simply putting a value on being antisocial is where the avant-garde slips into fascism.
That's right. The Garrett syndrome. And
the who syndrome, Bohemian. Sorry?
The Garrett, being the Bohemian.
Yeah. And hating everybody and thinking the more they hate you, the better you are. And you end up, and this has happened to many, I mean, even, you know, great avant-garde figures. I mean, Sergei Kuryokin, who I adore as a pianist and was the leader of the most amazing events in Russia. And we saw one event in 1989, Liverpool, that he curated in the Liverpool Town Hall just as the communism was collapsing. And he was our great hope for great hope. He was like the simplest way to say it. He was a Russian John Zorn, but he sounds completely different from Zorn. And but towards the end of his life, he began supporting the most fascist Russian chauvinist parties. And Leo Feigen, who's brought a lot of Russian music into England, said, well, he was looking for attention. But I think this understanding that the true role of art in bourgeois society is to be critical of society, is to be antisocial, means that one understands better why sometimes artists who are doing the most fantastic work will suddenly adhere to anything that shocks the liberals and get it all absolutely wrong.
No, I agree. And that is what we were talking about last show. The interplay, the tactile interplay between aesthetics and politics. That's an ongoing dialogue. Mm.
And I think Frank is an absolutely consummate example of somebody who understood the antisocial necessity of art and yet always... you know, right from the beginning, seemed to understand the sinister threat of fascism as this secret thing behind the curtains that the bourgeoisie keep to hit you in the face when they have a crisis. That understanding, I still don't understand where Frank got that deep political understanding of what fascism is. It still puzzles me. No, maybe he read it
from his father. He got it from his father. His father was a very interesting man and had a lot to say. That would be one thing. Tim Carey was an influence. Just his own genius, luckily, had the genius. Because look, in 1967, he's out there with Cecil Taylor and Roland Kirk, you know, in the village playing, and he's talking to Frank Kosky about forming a political party. Cecil Taylor wasn't doing that. Roland Kirk wasn't doing that. And 25 years later, he's talking about running for president. He stayed, in some people's view, still the bourgeois middle-class guy who was naively involved with democratic politics. You know, that was what he did. He was criticized by the Know-Nothings and the Isolated for doing that. But Frank was just showing that as a tactile citizen, working all levels, all the time, not going anywhere, and yet staying on point.
You know, Bob, when you talk about Frank in that really celebratory, enthusiastic way, you get a young quality to your voice, which is very different. It's special, man. It's really special. They should bottle it and put it in that stuff you spray on your chin when you shave yourself or something.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate the perception of that. It's probably true.
I derailed you with that simply because we are leading towards the end of the 14th Bob and Ben show. Though I'd like it to go on forever, actually.
How many more minutes we got? Five?
No, you got 30 seconds, man.
Well, I read this quote. page 292. But from the point of view of the revolutionary, there is no gap between Marx and Freud. Granted, two moldering mounds of irrelevant excrescence feed on their separate scholastic cadavers, but the materialist knows that the working class and the unconscious are two views of the same trap potential. The separation between objective class and subjective drive is a boundary only action can cross.
Hooray! Bye, Bob.
Okay, thank you, Ben.